gentlemen, I take off my coat because I have always been told it's best to come out fighting. then that perhaps puts people off asking too many awkward questions because they realise what might come back in retaliation. Thank you, Mrs. Hunt, for that introduction.
Good gracious, I've gone down here.
When I was asked to give this talk, it's very difficult to put the history of St. Kevin into a nutshell, so what I've tried to do is to take a précis of various items, similar to what we did last time when we did the effects of the war years on the history of St. Kevin. And tonight, with the help of my little blue book, which I treasure, I will attempt to take you back in time to the early 1880s. Had our chat taken place at that time, the Cornish language may well have been in full swing. Gone now, sad to say, by some of you, but perhaps due for resurgence as we go forward in time. Although I may look it, I can't quite recall the 1800s, although I may have been a caveman, as you were told about at the last meeting. However, I do recall much of the local dialect which came into being following the decline of the Cornish language, and in attempt to keep that dialect alive, I will fire off by quoting an extract taken from a meeting held in St. Kevin just before the 1900s. And my mother had this as a copy, and it reads, "What's the spouting about, Tom? I don't know enough, Fred, but I tell no I nod, and I don't know nothing now. I forget it more in 1 week than he ever nod. Don't count much for the old numbskull of them, do I? 'Tis wished, and has paid for it. That's how it is with this here education that they've got today. So I don't suppose it'll get much better. Oh, some mothers do have they, and they do rear they. Why, 'tis sad to say, 'cause we can do nothing about it. 'Tis the way the wind a blaw, as these might say, blawing nothing more than a passel of old twaddle. To my mind, 'tis worth nothing at all, is it? 'Tis nothing going nowhere." Now, I hope that won't be the cry after you've heard what I've got to say tonight. So, now to come back on more modern terms, from history, so much is to be learned both through success and failure, nationally and locally. St. Kevin holds no second place in that field, for our own history and heritage is foremost. The blue book in front of me, which I have compiled over the years, is steeped with fascination of what I hold as near and dear to our very existence. It contains accounts of many events now long past and perhaps forgotten, yet to others, interest may be the keynote. From the many articles covering the history and heritage of this parish, tonight I have chosen to relate a précis of St. Kevin Church and Churchyard's maritime history and links with the Manacle Reef and Prostock lifeboats. The whole article is far too long for presentation tonight, so some facts of great significance can only be of short acclaim. For that, I apologize, yet still offer respect to anyone who should have received special mention. It's like trying to put a quart into a pint pot, and oh, he do rack the old noodle to bring it in. With that fact foremost, I will endeavor to be as interesting as I can as we meander down memory lane to yesteryear, forgetting the toils, trials, and tribulations of today. So, to begin, much has been heard of, many stories related, yet few written accounts, indeed, if any, are actually available, covering the maritime history of our church and churchyard's connection with Prostock and its lifeboat station. Research is as difficult as the operation of various lifeboats from that station often proved. To cover the history completely, or at least in an attempt to do so, let us begin by approaching St. Kevin Village with all its maritime links. Try and imagine and picture in your mind's eye the vision on arriving in the village vicinity from a westerly direction, or for the more familiar of you, the brow of Doctor's Hill. First and foremost, the parish church, sentinel and focal point. Beyond, and stretching as far as the eye can see, Falmouth Bay, linked to the vast expanse of English Channel, and maybe, if the tide is such, a glimpse of the rugged coast and Manacle Reef, the centre from which much of this account will eventually culminate. History tells us the very name Manacles is derived from the Cornish language of Main Egolos, or Church Rocks, with all its significance to early mariners. Next, the village square, unique in itself and the envy of many a visitor. Situated in its centre, the war memorial, respect and remembrance to those in the locality who paid the supreme sacrifice of two world wars. Indeed, had it not been for their willingness to lay down their lives for others, we may not have been here today, a virtue shared by local lifeboatmen. Had our arrival to the village been in 1869, from whence the history of Prostock Lifeboat begins, and for those with long local memory, recollection will differ. For them, no bungalows stood in Doctor's Hill, no Pemmenor estate, the Ark, no butcher's shop, but a firmly established carpenter, wheelwright, and undertaker. No monastery close, a reservoir, no garage, no war memorial. For two or so thatched cottages occupied that site. Time inevitably brings change, no matter how hard one tries to resist. And whether we recall 1869 or today, progress, we are led to believe, must go on. Thus, with advancing steps and ever-advancing years, already aroused by the first glimpse of the parish church, let us wend our way to its entrance via the granite steps situated in the north corner of the square. Gone now are the thatched cottages from this corner, which for centuries guarded the church entrance. Eight steps lead to the lych gate, immediately in front of which, and on a level base, stands a large, long, narrow slab of granite, in shape not unlike a coffin. This slab was so positioned for a specific reason, to rest a coffin on and to give the bearers a respite prior to completing the uphill journey into the church and thence to the churchyard for committal and burial. Such a rest was often welcome, bearing in mind as in yesteryears, with no motor hearse, the body, coffin and mourners may have travelled many miles from the parish outer boundaries or surrounding coastline. Above the lych gate there used to be a room or small loft. This was referred to as the deadhouse, where bodies recovered from the shoreline were placed, awaiting identification if possible, then eventual burial. Today, on the rear lintel, there is still to be observed a tablet bearing the following inscription: that it may please thee to to forgive our enemies, persecutors, and slanderers. Signed, Norris, Vicar, Lamb, and Lohman, Wardens. In lighter note, it has been noted that when a certain corpse was placed on the granite slab, a bearer was heard to say, "'Tis a good job, 'tis past three, and the pub shut, because Billy would be out and gone." Billy loved his drop of drink, maybe from earlier time and association with smuggling activity. Be that as it may, bygones are bygones, and on now through the lich gate, when one is immediately struck by the splendour and architecture of the parish church. History tells us a church has stood on or near this site since the year 600. Today's structure, dating from 1200, Norman in design, consisting of three naves, tower and steeple. The former now supports a clock on its south and west face, backed by a very fine peal of eight bells. Well, of course, originally they were three, increased to eight, and today stand with a total of 10. And they are reputed to be amongst the finest in the county. The latter is adorned with a weather vane, which, due to its height, is of great accuracy. The four faces of the tower face directly north, south, east, and west. Both bells and clock are additions to the structure, having been installed in 1907 and dedicated by the then Lord Mayor of London, Sir William Trelawr, who was of St. Kevin ancestry. Much more could be related to the church and its associated history. Such would occupy great time and is not the sole purpose of this article. But nevertheless, because of its close association with maritime events and navigational assistance to mariners, must be mentioned. Its tall spire, visible for miles by day, assisted those who worked their wonders in the deep to avoid rock, reef, and rugged shore. Onward we wend, ascend a couple of steps through the rows of ancient headstones, and one is into the churchyard proper. Forward a few yards, bear left slightly, leave the belfry door on the right hand, when immediately vision is captivated by a truly outstanding view. In the foreground, the rolling countryside, and way beyond, the panorama of Falmouth Bay, offering magnificence second to none afforded by any stretch of coastline. Bear slightly right, and one is into the very heart of both maritime history and tragedy. On the left are to be found two headstones, one in memory of the Brig of War dispatch, dated January the 22nd, 1809, whilst the second stone is in memory of the emigrant ship John, dated 1855. Hardly is the reading of these two great disasters complete, when a few yards away, near the north door of the church, is to be discovered the grave of those who lost their lives in another wreck on the Manacle Reef, that of the SS Mohegan in October 1898. More on this will come later. Now, with curiosity and in silence, shadowed by reverence, on through the churchyard to the iron kissing gate marking the east boundary of God's sacred acre. Here, pause for a moment and ponder, and now gaze eastward with backs turned on the church and churchyard, and minds reliving the fate of so many mariners laid to rest. From our exit point, now also visible, the Carnew Rocks of the Manicots, and the bastion of that dreaded reef, which, if only they could speak, would have such a story to tell, and into whose face many a hardy mariner has faithfully looked. Meander through a couple of fields filled with lush grass and perhaps contented cows grazing, past Albert's old killing house in Tregenges Lane, through the valley with all the wonderful memories of Trenowth and Sir Frank Baines, who did so much to create the beauty adorning the valley walk. On past Trenowth Mill, and you'll find Boxer's Cottage and our first glimpse of Prostock Cove. But before the smell of the salt sea air, there is the aroma of Cooper Astron's rose garden. Now, I must tell you that Boxer came to work in St. Kevin Quarries when they were in their heyday. And initially, there was a big house in Prothostock, which was called the Lodging House, and many, many workers who came from other parts of the county put up there. Boxer must have made a bob of them, because eventually he managed to break away and go into the cottage in Trenowth Mill. Now, as a kid, he holds quite a lot of memory in my mind, and he had fought in World War I, and he always had expressions relating to the fact that he fought there. And he was on various committees in St. Kevin, and he would say, if anything went wrong, it's a bigger balls up than Mom's. That always stuck in my memory. And he had many, many things that he would say. And he was always referring to Vimy Ridge, but he was always capable of bringing up the right little bit of comment, maybe at the wrong time, I don't know. It might have been a church meeting, for all I know. But having gone through, I said we come to Cooper Astron's Rose Garden. Now, that's the first little cottage on the left. And he came down here and retired, but he was a great developer of roses, and the smell was out of this world. And he erected, and it's still there, a little tablet which says, you are nearer God's heart in a garden than anywhere else on earth. And every time I walk by there, I still think how appropriate that is. And of course, after that, Prostock now unfolds its maritime legend and its Manicot history. Of course, there is the dreaded Manicot Reef, which we have to think about. And for all the navigational hazards to be encountered around the coast of Cornwall, these sinister rocks must have claimed the biggest toll of shipping, ironically so close to the welcome portals of a safe haven, Falmouth. In the days of sail, vessels leaving and arriving at Falmouth with easterly winds and ebb tides were particularly vulnerable, but proposals in 1825 to construct a lighthouse on the Manicles and renewed from time to time fell on stony ground. However, the erection of St. Anthony Lighthouse did improve the situation, and a bigger buoy was emplaced on the eastern side of the Manicles. And yet, the link with the churchyard and the Manicles still stands foremost. For at any season of the year, strong winds, especially in winter, whistle and howl around the handsome church of St. Kevin, whose steeple and tower has been a navigational aid to mariners for centuries, and whose brooding atmospheric churchyard in this maritime setting provided a last resting place for scores of shipwrecked victims. Also, in more detail, among them were those aboard the Transport Dispatch, which struck Lowland Point with the loss of 120 lives on January the 22nd, 1809, and the Brig of War Primrose, which became a casualty of the Manacles the same night with the loss of 125 lives. Prior to an established lifeboat station at St. Kevin, at the coast, local fishermen, coast guards, and others went to the aid of distressed ships in their own boats, often risking their own lives in trying to save others. In 1828, pro-stock men saved the 5 crewmen from the schooner Auspicious wrecked on the Manacles, and some years later, 4 lives were saved from the schooner St. Ives by the smack Mary Ann and local boatmen. On the occasion of another major disaster, on May the 3rd, 1855, when the emigrant ship John struck the Manacles and drifted towards Lowland Point, the future lifeboat coxswain, James Hill, was among the fishermen who put to sea to help save 91 of the 286 on board. There is a memorial to James Cliff at the north exit of the church to this day. It is interesting to mention, at the subsequent inquest of those disasters, James Hill said, "I went to Prostock, half-dressed, and got 2 boats out. Finding we could not clear the point, we returned. 3 of us went out again and met the other boat returning, and we were told it was impossible to reach the wreck. About an hour later, we launched the boats again and succeeded in getting to the ship. We picked up 1 man from a boat and a woman and 9 men from a raft and landed them at Tom's Cove." Now, do you know where Tom's Cove is?
No.
There you are. Well, if you go down to Lowland Point and then look at Dean Quarry, there's a bay there, and that bay is called Tom's Cove. Now, you've learned something tonight, if nothing else. We landed them at Tom's Cove, where they were helped up the cliffs by neighbours. We made 3 other trips to the John and saved 50 lives. Our crew were myself, still people of this vintage or this relationship around. Our crew were myself, my son James, Billy Mathis, Thomas Pierce, Henry Tripconey, and James O'Connor. Also, at the same inquest, Coast Guard Thomas Clear of Covert reported, "We arrived at Prostock about 12:30 a.m. and joined the fishermen there. We launched 3 boats, but the boat I was in was overmanned, and the sea was so rough we were obliged to put back. We tried again with fewer men, with no better result. An hour later, with coast guards, a fisherman from Prostock, and myself, we made 3 trips to the wreck and saved 35 lives." Now we'll refer to the situation of the boathouse at Prostock. You're all familiar with it. It's the village hall today. But in view of the recurring tragedies, it is surprising that a lifeboat station was not established in this little fishing cove adjacent to the Manacles until 1869, when the disaster of HMS Despite again focused attention on the local danger. When the boathouse was constructed at the head of the creek, the sea was not too distant, and launching over the beach was relatively easy. Well, in those days, the sea almost lapped the actual lifeboat house door. So a boat was in the water in a very short period of time. But waste materials from the adjacent quarries, which washed back into the cove, caused the floor of the inlet to build up and increased the distance to the now sharply shelving water's edge and imperiled launching, especially when the wind was in the east. This situation also had an adverse effect on the local fishing industry and hastened its decline. Now, it's very interesting because that was advocated, that situation was developed by the coxswain of Pro Stock Lifeboat at that time. And he told them that if they kept tipping their overburden at the point, the cove would fill up and it would finish Pro Stock as a natural harbour. Now we'll deal with Pro Stock's first lifeboat. The station's first lifeboat, the Mary Ann Story, was 33 feet long and rowed by 10 oars, and that arrived in September 1869 and was put through her trials at sea after having been proudly displayed through the streets of Helston with her crew decked out in their lifeboat gear. And that apparently was a very rousing sight and really brought into being the support necessary for the lifeboat institution. Her first service was in January 1872, when five lives were saved from the bark cabinet of Newcastle. And the following year, she escorted the Danish brig Alexander away from the dangerous manacles, thereby preventing loss of life and shipwreck, demonstrating the practical advantages of a lifeboat station close to a navigational hazard. An intimate knowledge of home waters and expert seamanship also paid off in saving 23 lives from the Ceres of Greenock and five from the schooner Georgiana of Liverpool in 1877 and 1881. The Mary Ann Story last saw service in April 1884 when she helped the shipwrecked crewmen of the SS Lady Dalhousie of Greenock to help themselves in salvaging possessions and stores before their vessel slid beneath the waves after having hit the manacles. The Mary Ann Story was replaced in 1886 by the larger lifeboat, Charlotte, constructed by Forrest and Company of Lyons. Now we come on to the great blizzard of March 1891. James Henry Trelaw Cliff, who succeeded James Hill as coxswain in 1907, after serving as a second coxswain for 13 years, was recognized a first-class swimmer and instrumental in saving many lives. As the great blizzard of March 1891 was casting its ugly spell, James Cliff noticed a distressed small smack which turned out to be the Dove making a run for the beach at Pro Stock and ran to assist. Then, backed up by helpers on the shore, he tied a rope around his waist and waded through the boiling surf to rescue two men and a boy, who were then sheltered in his and the neighbouring cottage. People living in nearby Rosnaitham, defying the ravages of the blizzard, alerted the lifeboat crew to two vessels anchored to the north of Pro Stock Cove, which turned out to be the Ketch Edwin and the sloop Aquila of Guernsey, but it was unable to launch because of the tremendous seas raging at that time. Coverack Rocket Brigade was summoned, and James Cliff again roped himself and was lowered down the cliff abreast of the vessel. Sadly, the helpers were forced to witness the sad sight of the two little ships and their doomed crews being battered and claimed by the cruel sea. The situation went from bad to worse as the fury of the blizzard increased, with a disastrous wreck of the four-masted, fully rigged Bay of Panama on their head to the north of Pearl. Yet, once again, James Cliff, accompanied by two others, headed off over cliff tops with ropes and grapnels to see what they could do, whilst the rocket apparatus was also summoned from cover. From the cliff top, they observed the once grand, now pitiful ship in disarray, with angry waves beating over her, and they clambered down the cliff to join the Prella men, who were trying to get a line aboard to the few remaining survivors. For many had been either carried away by the aft mast or frozen to death in the rigging, as had been the fate of the captain's wife. Those who had survived thus far had been off duty, below deck, and were hauled ashore with a line fired by the rocket apparatus, and later taken to Falmouth. Due to atrocious weather conditions, communication had gone hopelessly wrong, and a well-known story of heroism tells of Joe James, a butcher's boy, who walked and often crawled his way through the snow to Falmouth in order to alert the authorities of the great disaster on the Nare Head. The lot of a lifeboatman was never easy. Questions were asked as to why no lifeboat was launched on these occasions, and the crew stated ignorance of an emergency, and their reservations about launching gave rise to the possibility of having a smaller lifeboat here, requiring fewer men to crew her. However, in the event, the Charlotte went away and returned, having been fitted with two drop keels. Now we come on to something which we know perhaps a bit more about, the Mohegan disaster. Records show 7 were saved from the ship's boat of the brig Dryad of Whitehaven, and 28 from the Andola of Liverpool just prior to the Mohegan. And there were standby services with a bark and a steamship before the major disaster of the SS Mohegan of Hull occurred in October 1898. This modern and luxurious ship, which was felt to be unlucky from the start, was described by one of her captains as a whore by name and a whore by nature. And this was in conversation with someone from the Helford Passage area. Constructed for the Wilson Furness Leyland line by Earl Shipping Company of Hull as the Cleopatra, she was sold to the Atlantic Shipping Company of London before launching, and her first trip across the Atlantic was beset by problems. Now, she had extensive repairs carried out in New York, and they were still dubious about her safety, and she had to return with no passengers at all. And after she had been overhauled back here again, she was renamed the Mohegan in 1898, and under the command of Captain Griffiths, with 53 passengers, 97 crew, 7 cattlemen, and a general cargo, she sailed. And on their way down the English Channel, elegantly attired passengers were settling down to dinner or preparing for sophisticated shipboard socializing as their vessel inexplicably set on the wrong course, struck the outer manacle reef. In quick succession, the metal plates of the engine room lifted, water rushed in, the lights went out, and the ship went down amid screams from those on board. James Hill, the coxswain of the lifeboat, who had noticed the lights of a large vessel on the danger course close to the shore, summoned his crew, and the lifeboat was underway in less than half an hour in moderate sea conditions. Not surprisingly, there was no response to their white light, and the casualty was difficult to locate on the manacles at first. Assistant coxswain James Cliff, who had been up to St. Kevin, was told of the disaster and requested to take a backup crew out in the old lifeboat. But as this was battered and ill-equipped, he decided on the best boat on the beach, and with a volunteer crew of four, headed in the direction from which the cries of distress had been heard. Coxswain Hill and his men aboard the Charlotte came across an upturned boat with two men hanging on. Then they heard cries coming from underneath, and after righting the boat with much difficulty, they found two women and a child. More cries alerted them to another battered ship's boat, almost filled with water, yet holding 24 people. The lifeboat took the survivors ashore, where they were cared for by locals. In the meantime, the second coxswain's boat had located the wreck on the main Varses, what we call them the Voices today, and James Cliff had signalled reassurance to the survivors by setting fire to his own necktie and shouting that they were returning for reinforcements as their boat was undermanned. Fortunately, their return to Prostock coincided with that of the lifeboat, which meant that James Cliff could transfer to the Charlotte and direct her to the wreck. As he recalled later, when we arrived back at the wreck, they saw us as we again burned the light, and they all shouted. But it was very difficult approaching her, as on her starboard side were the main Varses rocks with a heavy sea breaking over them. And on the other side, when we tried to get near, the boat's derricks were sticking out of the water, and we were a long time manoeuvring to drop the anchor in the right position. An anchor is dropped to prevent the boat running back and onto the victim or the rocks. Quartermaster John W.H. Juddery, one of the heroes of the rescue, who had assisted the passengers before the ship sank, eventually joined others in the mizzen rigging. And when the lifeboat arrived, he swam out to establish a line by which they were saved. 44 people survived this horrendous shipwreck, while 106, including the captain and most of his officers, were lost. Newspapers reported a harrowing sequence of events leading up to a mass burial in St. Kevin Churchyard. The RNLI awarded silver medals to Coxswain James Hill and Quartermaster Jodery for gallant conduct. The bereaved King family of Connecticut donated an inscribed memorial bell, which was incorporated in the Peal of Eight and inaugurated by Sir William Trelaw, Lord Mayor of London, and cousin of Coxswain James Henry Trelaw Cliff, on May the 9th, 1907. A memorial window was placed within the church, and a granite cross inscribed Mohegan positioned near the north door. In May the following year, the American liner SS Paris, bound from Cherbourg for New York, carrying a general cargo, a crew of 370 and 386 passengers, ran aground at Lowland Point, not far from the site of the Mohegan disaster. Fortunately, the sea was calm, and after some delay in locating her in thick fog, the lifeboat went alongside, allowing second coxswain James Cliff to climb aboard and advise on the situation. A tug was requested. The passengers, who were taken off by Prostoke lifeboat, were transferred to the tug Triton and conveyed back to Falmouth, realising what a lucky escape they had had. As the fog dispersed, so the massive ship became visible from the shore. Later, she was refloated and towed to Falmouth for temporary repair. From Falmouth, she sailed repaired temporarily to Belfast, where, after extensive renovation, she was renamed the Philadelphia. In 1917, she became the United States Armed Transport, Harrisburg, and after being sold in 1925 to the New York Naval Steamship Company, she served briefly as an emigrant ship and then became scrapped. The lifeboat Charlotte was replaced in 1900 by the James Stevens No. 17. But the climax of the station had passed. John George had been the very first coxswain in 1869. James Hill took over 9 years later, at the age of 34. He, a tough lifeboatman of the old school, retained the position of coxswain until he reached 70, which meant that James Henry Trelaw Cliff, who had served as second coxswain for so long, was coxswain for only 3 years. William Henry Tripp took his place in 1908 and was superseded by George Martin Tripconi in 1922 and Joseph William Tripconi in 1935. By this time, the decline of sail, the increase in steam, and improving technology were paying their part in reducing the toll of the manacles. The James Stevens performed standby duty in 1919 and saved the SS Dolphin of Manchester and 8 lives, placing a crewman aboard and escorting her to safety. Later that year, the 20-year-old lifeboat Queen Victoria, constructed by Roberts of Mevagissey, arrived having formerly served at Bembridge. Another second-hand lifeboat, the Cape Walker, which had served at Lynmouth, replaced her 9 years later. A lifeboat constructed for Prostock in the yard of Groves and Gutteridge was destroyed in an air raid during the Second World War. However, times were changing, and the increased difficulty in getting the lifeboat across the greater distance to the water's edge, the shortage of men to crew her, and the decreasing demand for her services, which could now be covered by Falmouth Watson class and a boat at Cover. And this led to a temporary closure in 1942 and a permanent shutdown in 1945. You must also remember that technology was taking over, helicopters were slowly coming into being, Coverick had a better placed lifeboat, they could get their lifeboat into the sea in much less time. But it's also interesting to note that when there was a wreck, the local signalman who for all my existence was Simon Boyle, was entrusted with the job of setting off the rockets. This was a very, very dangerous affair, and he took great pride and interest in doing it. Now, Billy, his son, who still lived, was always dead keen to have a go at this, but defied by his father from the very beginning. One day, after a long wait, this opportunity came. There was a double funeral in St. Kevin. A lady had died in childbirth, and Simon and his wife went to the funeral. Well, they hadn't been in church very long before the word flashed around that it was a wreck. So Billy thought to himself, here's my chance. I'm in success at last. So he went to the shed where everything was kept, grabbed the whole lot, and they used to set them off in the little field above where Wallace was estimating. And he thought, well, I must make a good job of this. So he decided to give it a double dose of everything. And then he set the fuse and thought to himself, well, I like this. But the fuse was too short, and before he could do very much about it, the whole lot went off. And Billy, in desperation, heard such a terrific bang, he swung himself down in the field, got covered in mud, with his head in the ground. Now, the first thing that went through his mind, my God, I've blown the church up and killed everybody. So, after a while, he thought to himself, well, I'd better get up and see what's happened. Well, he looked at the church, that was still there. So he thought, well, that isn't bad. But in quick succession, his father rushed in through the gate with a bowler hat and walking stick and belted the daylight out of him. That was his reward for all things, for what he'd done. And I would like to conclude the little story by, first of all, saying what Sir Winston Churchill spoke of the lifeboat. And this is what he said. It drives on with a courage which is stronger than the storm. It drives on with mercy, which does not quail in the presence of death. It drives on as a proof, a symbol, a testimony that man is created in the image of God, and that valor and virtue have not perished in the British race. That, I think, is terribly applicable to the lifeboatmen of the past and again today. Now, I have here a poem which was written by a local person, a W. Quintrell of Camborne. And the interesting thing, it cost tuppence to buy. And it says, an original poem on the Mohegan, an Atlantic liner, which was wrecked on the Manical Rocks, a few miles west of Falmouth, on October the 14th, 1898. In memory of such, a window has been erected in St. Kevin Church, which bears the following scripture. To the glory of God, and in memory of 106 persons who perished in the wreck of the SS Mohegan on the Manical Rocks, October the 14th, 1898. This window was erected by the Atlantic Transport Company, owners of the vessel, signed W.M. Quintrell, 21 Wesley Street, Camborne. And I think the poem is superb, and it goes, have you heard of the Manacle, sir? That spot that the mariner dread, by which many a gallant sailor has found a watery bed? I mean that long reef of rocks, sir, that lies on the southern side, a few miles west of Falmouth, that's washed by the ebbing tide. They're only a mile from the mainland. A mile? Yes, sir, that's all. They stand just off Prostock, that fishing village small. And many a time the Charlotte, Prostock's lifeboat brave, has gone through storm and danger to rescue and to save. How oft in darkened tempest, when storms have been severe, has mariner thought of rocks, sir, and dreaded danger near. But down at end of reef, sir, there floats a buoy with bell. Place there a message of hope, to sound the Manacle's knell. I will tell a piteous story that happened on this dangerous reef. A noble vessel foundering mid sorrow, sadness, grief. Her name, it was Mohegan, a steamship 2 years old. Her captain's name was Griffiths, experienced, stout, and bold. It was her second voyage, owned by the AGC, used an Atlantic liner to sail across the sea. 7,000 was her tonnage, a transport steamer new, with passengers full 53, 108 her crew. Bound from the port of London, New York, her destined place, she left the Thames behind her as brightly shone each face. Came down the channel steaming, all things were jolly and bright. They saw the Eddystone grandly mid fading evening light. The night was clear and starlit, the sea rolls before, the ship was gliding grandly with the captain to the fore. They thought, ere many hours, they would the channel leave and reach the sweeping ocean. No danger did conceive. The gong rang out for dinner, which in the saloon was spread. They ate and drank light-hearted, no thought of death or dread. But while they sat at table, the ship was going to grief, for straightway she was steering right on the dreaded reef. Then came the fatal moment, in spite of rocket light, of grating, crashing, tearing, as each one stood affright. Then, with a fearful rushing on deck, it told its tale. They saw their doom and danger, whilst each one's cheek grew pale. The ship began to founder, she throbbed from stem to stern. The waters filled her cabins, and each one's heart did yearn. Just a few moments later, her engines ceased to go. Her electric lights were darkened as she reeled to and fro. The boats were quickly lowered. A voice rang out quite clear. The ladies burst in children, we have no time to spare. Then came a fearful lurching, likewise a dreaded shock, and then she sank all broken beside the jagged rock. The sea was quickly peopled amidst the watery roar, whose cries were heard distinctly some 4 miles from the shore. Some clung to bits of wreckage, at floating spars they caught, whilst others climbed the rigging or to the funnel got. The scene, it was appalling around this dreaded reef, with boats and mass of wreckage, with cries that sought relief. Men, women, children struggled, they struggled but to fail, and from the hideous darkness there rose a bitter wail. At last the lifeboat proudly, the Charlotte's crew so brave, did venture from prowstock to pull abreast the wave. The waves were hard to battle, but still they sought to dare, defying self for others, their fellows' wants to share. They went to work in earnest, in spite of rock and wave, and very soon succeeded, just 29 to save. And then across the water, they sought the cove to reach, and bravely, safely landed them on Prowstock Beach. Again they breast the waters, the self-denying crew, to reach the broken wreckage and save again a few. And then the noble housewife flung open wide her door to care for shipwrecked strangers who had been brought ashore. Oh, how they cheered the lifeboat when last survivor came. All honour to Prowstock, men shall revere the name. Some 50 lives were saved, sir, from battling with a wave, saved in the midst of danger, by noble men so brave. How sad indeed the story, a wreck so near to land, 12 miles out of her course, sir, we cannot understand. But by her steering madly, 100 lives were lost, while others suffered sorrow at a tremendous cost. May this teach us a lesson on life's great channel we, to heed the rocks and breakers a warning from the sea. Unless we heed the rudder, the rocks will bring us grief, and like the ship, shall perish on life's long rugged reef. Now, I think that bit of poem is quite amazing, and if I can find it, I would like to finish up with a little bit of local dialect to see how clued up you all are. We did this at the end of the last little talk we had, and I've got a few words here and whatnot. Now, does anybody know what a maul is?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, come on.
Yeah.
A basket?
Yeah.
All right. What's a flasket? That's right, that's all right. What a brand is?
Three-legged iron thing for fire.
Well done, well done. A slab?
A
frigate?
Well, they're getting the three-legged iron affair.
No, no,
the slab. It's covered by the slab.
Are you saying a fringle rustle?
Yeah, but that slab first, never coming out of the fringle.
Well, it's an open space by the side of stone.
Another little grit.
You're right.
Another little grit. Yeah, that's all right. What's the space?
Under the stairs.
Under the stairs. Under the stairs.
Yeah, covered. Where is it?
Under the stairs.
Got it. Well done. Now, what's a safe?
Safe point. Well, that's what the goes outside. He's keeping it indoors. You can read it.
That's right. Not money.
No.
A lot of us say there's money, but there's a cold store for perishable goods. All right? Planching.
A floorboard.
Sorry, what is it?
A planching. Ah, there you are.
They're floorboards, that's all surely.
That's right. You go. Clone.
Not a word from China.
That's right. Flink.
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 Just
gesticulate.
Right, like that.
Yeah.
That's
flinking. Shit. The shit. Flink is the shit. You go from there. Wallop. Right. Wallop.
Go along.
Yeah. There you go. You're coming there, right? Soak.
Oh,
all right, good. Spurt.
Go quickly.
Eh?
Go quickly.
That's right, you're all right there. Go.
Swallow.
Swallow. Clonk.
Same thing.
You see where the drinkers are, can't you? Famish.
Hungry.
Eh?
Hungry.
Famish. You say hungry.
Yeah.
Well, that's all right. Or thirsty, whichever they are. Force and back.
Force and back.
And on front.
Wrong way
round. Wrong way round. You wrote that, all right. Lumber.
Rubbish.
Rubbish. Ebba.
Just a funny
amount. Ebba. 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 Something on. Is it that
ever? That ever, or can you name more an adjective?
Well,
no. Ever. Now, come on, Anne. You've got to bother ever for sweets.
Yeah.
Well, we've gone a bit further for a penna. That's right, you've got that one. Frazzle.
Oh,
okay. It's an old local dialect. Come on, you've got a lot to learn yet. Scrump up.
Scrump up.
That's
right,
scrumped off.
Mayors.
Ah, right, that's right. Prowl.
Prowl. Get them at night.
Like, well, if you were proud, you had a gang of people coming on behind you.
Yeah.
You couldn't get rid of them. They prowled it. Roop.
Roop.
Roop. Roop. Well, you know some people will make a noise when they're eating. That roop, that rooping. If anybody say to you, you're rooping, they know you know you're rooping back. Say, Rickler. A rickler.
It's a berry.
Ah, you're getting near it. He's a woolly ant. He's a woolly ant.
Not woolly ant.
Stevie. Stevie.
Pardon?
Stevie.
Cole.
Ah, that's right. You've got it. They say we'll find Stevie in the valley. There's cold in the valley. Now, I'm sure you all know what a faggot is.
Yes.
Yes.
Bundle of sticks.
Bundle of sticks. All right. Brace.
Broad scrambles.
Nice. Bisco. Bisco.
Finger stole.
Ah, you got it. You've been sipping your finger. That's how you know. He made a funny old taste. Tenser.
A regular waist.
Right, that's all right.
A prime bag is that, or a West of England bag.
Well, usually made from an old guano bag. Do we know the guano bag here? That's right. that's right. Bennett.
Oh, it's a
tool,
isn't it?
A finish? Is it a tool?
Like a digger.
That's right. Now, you all know what an evil is, don't you?
Yeah.
Right. An old scale.
Albert tree.
Right. And it's a puke on top of the grass.
Some, I reckon.
It's good.
Well, it's good. Put down.
Scat. Wind.
Small P.
Yeah, small P. Ale.
Ale to one boy.
Eh?
Ale to one
boy. Ale to one boy, yeah, all right. Pull. Launder, you know all that one.
Yeah,
all right, that's all right. Cunder.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
That's all right. Forthy.
Forthy.
Well, plenty to say. That's right, you've got a lot to say. Tubba.
Tubba. Small.
It's not a bird.
That's right. Old, where is he? Tubba. A yarrock.
Yeah,
let's
string it around.
All right, that's right. Just like the mice going up your leg in the harvest.
Keep the mud.
Now, you haven't done too bad there, but you've got to remember a bit more for next time.